welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal print magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhaus doing his thing in the background. Thank you, John, for letting us use your music. On today's podcast, you guys may note, careful Fretboard Journal podcast listeners, usually these episodes come out on Fridays. I am racing this one out the door because our guest, Mike Baghetta, is on the road right now, and he's hitting a bunch of East Coast tour dates later this week. And I want to make sure all of you guys over there know about him, know about his tour, because everyone listening to this should go check it out. Mike is an incredible jazz guitarist. We talk about his influences, but if you are into David Torn or Bill Frisell or Henry Kaiser, you definitely need to know about Mike. And he has a new record out called Wall of Flowers that has the insane rhythm section of Jim Keltner and Mike Watt on it. And we talk a lot about the making of this album. It was created in a very unique process. It's the first time Mike Watt and Jim Keltner have ever played together, which is equally cool. And I don't know. My mind was blown talking to Mike about the creation of this album, as well as his gear, what he's been using. We cover so much ground. We talk about improvising. We talk about goal setting. Mike is just, as you will hear, one of the coolest guys who has walked through these doors, and I think you will love this interview. On the road right now, he is touring with Watt, as well as drummer Stephen Hodges, no slouch himself, and check out his tour dates. Again, Mike Baghetta, Wall of Flowers. You can also stream the album or download it in all of the usual places. Not much else to report around here. Fretboard Journal 44 will be out shortly in mid-April. So if you haven't subscribed to the Fretboard Journal print magazine yet, I sure hope you will. Go to fretboardjournal.com, get a 1, 2, or 3-year subscription, and use the coupon code PODCAST, and I will take $5 off of your order. We are very much a reader-supported media company, which means our magazine doesn't have a ton of advertising, our podcast doesn't have a ton of advertising, but readers and listeners really support us. So if you want to show your support for this podcast, if you love the diversity of everything that we cover, both on the podcast as well as online, support us, please. And for those of you out there who have been subscribing for years and wanting to know how you can help us out in a bigger way, since we don't have a Fretboard Summit planned anytime soon, the easiest way to support us is by going to the new Fretboard Journal Insider program, which you can find at fretboardjournal.com/insider. That is your way to help us out on a monthly basis and show your support. It is for the true fans out there. Maybe you've been subscribing for over a decade. Maybe we've turned you on to your favorite luthiers. Maybe we've changed your life in some small way. Go to fretboardjournal.com/insider. It's kind of the Criterion collection of the magazine. We are sharing outtakes and bonus footage and podcasts and videos that have never seen the light of day, as well as inviting you to these incredibly cool sessions that we do here at the Fretboard Journal offices. Speaking of which, Mike, when we did the podcast, we recorded 2 insanely beautiful solo tracks from the record of just Mike playing. So those will be up on our website very soon. All right, without further ado, here is my talk with Mike Baghetta. Again, the album is called Wall of Flowers, and if you are anywhere on the East Coast, go to his website, check out his tour dates, because he might be coming to a town near you. Hey, thanks for being on the podcast, Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me. Was that the whole thing?
That was the whole thing. We're just going to start rolling. So you have a record out with the most amazing rhythm section known to mankind. Not to sell your guitar playing short.
I'm biased, but I would agree with that, yeah.
How'd it come together? I mean, tell me about it.
Well, so yeah, the record Wall of Flowers is with Mike Watt on bass and Jim Keltner on drums. And actually, it's funny how it came together. It came together because, in a way, I had always just sort of equated those two players as having maybe not like similar qualities per se, like on the surface level, but sort of similar musical factors in their playing, yeah. Aspects of their playing that I loved completely, but I thought were related. And over the years, I've kind of thought always a little surprising that they'd never recorded together. Mm-hmm. I think maybe to a lot of listeners, it's probably not surprising at all that they've never recorded together. They're kind of associated with pretty different musical realms. in a certain sense. But anyways, my good friend Chris Schlarb, who runs Big Ego Studio in Long Beach, California.
Okay.
And he also runs the label, and he also produced the record, and did countless other things to make this possible. We've been friends for a while, and he told me he was starting a label, asked me if I'd be interested in doing a record for him. And I said, of course. And he says, well, what do you want to do? And I just sort of jokingly thought, like, oh, I want to do a trio record with Mike Watt and Jim Keltner, right? If for no other reason, so that I can finally hear these guys play together. You know, it was very, like, selfish in a way. And, you know, we laughed and laughed. We just saw this as, like, sort of an impossibility of anything ever coming from it. But then over, like, the next year or two, we kind of got more serious about it. He says he called my bluff. We sort of just thought, like, oh, we could actually maybe do this. And it wouldn't never have happened without Chris. He made the calls. He put it together. He provided an outlet for this music to happen. So eternally grateful to him. But the stars aligned, and we could all kind of get together on this one day at the studio in Long Beach. So I flew out from East Knoxville, Tennessee, where I live now. And we had one day together in the studio for the three of us. I did a separate day of some of the solo material that's on this album. Mm-hmm. And we recorded the two sort of composed songs on the record, Hospital Song and Wall of Flowers. And then I asked them if they'd be interested in trying to improvise some music, because that's something that's important to my music and what I like to do with different musicians. And they were down to try it. And we just sort of did free improv for 20 minutes. And at the end of it, everybody was kind of quiet, but there was sort of an aura of like, wow, that worked. That was really fun to do. Uh-huh. And I think Schlarb came out of the control room, and I looked at him and I was like, that was good, right? That's the record. We should do more of this. He's like, yeah, go. So then we improvised for about another 3.5 hours, something like that.
Wow.
So there's all this material of free improv between me and Watt and Keltner. Two tracks on the album, I'm Not a Data Point, Dirty Smell of Dying. Those are very small portions of this improvised material that I took and kind of rearranged, and then I overdubbed and recomposed some more material too, based on some of the stuff that we had improvised, which is not a new idea. You know, that's,
yeah.
I learned that from David Torn, but there's a lot of other people that have done it as well. And kind of turn them into pieces that make a lot of sense sort of musically, but it all grows out of the contributions of all three of us in that moment. And that was really kind of the magical thing about this album to me.
Yeah. But you came into the studio with two or three tracks where you're like, I know.
I came in with nine tunes.
Yeah,
I'd written nine pieces for this recording. We did two of them. And then we just started improvising. That was the rest. I mean, it was so much fun to do that. And it was the thing that was going to be better than anything I had written. You know, like if they were down to do it and it was going to work, absolutely 100 times over, I would choose that again. Because I can always write something and get people to play it,
mm-hmm.
You know, different people of varying types of players. But there's something so magical about this thing that I could have never written. I could have never imagined, because both of them are contributing their experience and all of their musicality to it, which is just inherently theirs. I only have what's mine, you know, to come up with this whole that is so much greater than anything that I brought just from my own one perspective, to have three different perspectives fully invested.
Yeah.
I would always choose that. So when we got the sense that that was happening, yeah, forget the stack of stuff. Let's just roll with this, you know?
Yeah.
Cause this will definitely never happen again.
Yeah.
You know, not necessarily that the three of us wouldn't do something together, but, this music being created and existing in this moment will never happen again,
mm-hmm.
You know.
On the two tunes that you came in with, how far did they stray from what you were hearing in your head with those guys behind it?
They strayed somewhat in the sense that they were exponentially better than I could have imagined them sounding.
Yeah.
You know, the forms and stuff were not nothing really changed for that. I tend not to kind of come in with like, oh, I need this kind of beat and I need the bass line to sort of be this. I really value the contributions of the people that I'm playing with, and I want those to be an important part of the music that I make or that we try to make together.
Yeah. So tell me, after this marathon session, are Jim and Mike friends now? Is it all rosy?
Man, it was a great day. None of us had met before. The three of us had not met.
Jim, you had never met Watt either?
I'd never met Watt. Okay. I'd never met Jim. Jim and Watt had never met. So we all met that day, you know, and it was just so total pro, wonderful. Everybody was so cool and generous, easy to work with. And like I said, like, it felt really invested. Like, they were willing to kind of just try stuff.
Yeah.
And really just be there, fully committed. It was really incredible. Yeah.
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 All right. So that's what you've been up to lately. Where'd you grow up?
Well, I also want to add.
Yeah, go for it.
That's the album.
Yeah.
But the tour is with a different drummer.
Yeah.
Equally incredible special drummer named Stephen Hodges, who a lot of people would know being in Mavis Staples' band for the last 10, 12 years, something like that. He's also on a number of Tom Waits records. He's done some work with David Lynch. You know, the list goes on and on. For me, though, I first heard about Stephen Hodges from Watt's first opera, Contemplating the Engine Room. That album, which is had a huge impact on me musically and the way I think about music. Obviously, Watt, Stephen Hodges on drums, and Nels Klein on guitar.
Yeah.
So just absorbing that album for so many years, I would never in a million years thought that I would have the chance to play with essentially that rhythm section, you know, not to use kind of a belittling term, but not that that's a belittling term, but to play with Mike Watt and Stephen Hodges on my own music. Then Watt also suggested we do a couple albums from Engine Room on this tour we're doing this week. So it's, you know, it's kind of a mind blow. I feel like, you know, the luckiest boy in the toy store.
Where were you at when you found that record?
I was in college.
Okay.
I did not buy it. Somebody taped it for me.
Oh.
Gave it to me.
Yeah.
I did buy it later, and then I wore out the CD. It got all, like, filthy in my car and broke. But I did just buy the vinyl reissue. It came out in Record Store Day a couple years ago, so I bought that. But I was probably... I was probably, you know, maybe 19, maybe 20 years old.
Okay.
I was in college at Rutgers University. I was going there for music, for jazz studies, you know, jazz school, which was great. And I learned so much from so many people. But I'd always loved a lot of different types of music. And it was getting to a point for me where it was hard to sort of rationalize, like, oh, if I'm going to be a quote unquote jazz musician, I have to do this. I have to play this instrument and I got to sound like this. Otherwise I'm a rock musician, or I play this guitar and I sound like this.
Yeah.
So there's all these kinds of sort of conflicting things, which I think now is very much more common and sort of a little more easily navigable maybe than I felt it was in that era, or at least for me. But anyways, when I heard Watt's record, when I heard Contemplating the Engine Room, the thing that I mostly heard in there were two things. One was that it crossed all these sort of different genres very effortlessly from piece to piece with the same trio. It wasn't like, oh, I had to bring in another person to do this part. And, you know, it's basically just, it's all these three guys, and there's so many different genres on this album that I thought, oh, this guy's done it. You know, this Mike Watt guy, he's found a way to sort of just use music sort of pan genreistically to create something that serves what he wants to do musically. There's no compromise. So that made me feel like, oh, maybe I can find a way to do this for my own music too. So that was number one. And the second thing about it was just sort of the emotional content of that piece. The subject matter of the opera, of the pieces, is so raw and emotional for, you know, based on experiences in his life. And I had always, you know, people say, oh, you can express yourself through music, you can express emotional qualities through sounds. And I sort of understood that, and I kind of got that. But hearing what he did with that music, it really got into my heart and made me feel like, oh, you people really can express themselves through music, you know? So it took on a much deeper understanding for me, kind of just internally, when I heard something like that. It just, that album made so much for me click, you know. So then, and here I am playing Wall of Flowers music, and there's Michael and Steven, and
yeah,
you know, and Nels has been a good friend to me and helped me out a little bit over the years too. So it's
did your Watt appreciation go back further? Were you a Minutemen fan and all that stuff?
I had double nickels in high school, you know, and I definitely was into the Stooges stuff that was coming out when he was with them. But I, you know, I mean, admittedly, I wasn't like a fervent, like feverish, like all about the Minutemen kind of thing, but they were definitely in the catalog of stuff that I loved to listen to, which spanned, you know, from Minutemen to Nirvana to Jim Hall to Rachmaninoff, you know, and on and on, you know. So
did you have a cool older sibling or just a cool record store or college radio, or what was going for you?
Well,
you were able-
check this story out. I have a cool older sibling, my sister Angela. She's 4 years older. She doesn't really do music per se, and I haven't asked her about that. I've mentioned this in a couple of interviews, and I haven't asked her about this. I kind of want to keep it a mystery, so I might never ask her about this. But when I was in high school, I think I might have been like 14, 15, or 16, and I was starting to play guitar and kind of starting to just sort of make some weird sounds or something. I guess I sort of always liked that side, that sort of experimental side of it. And anyways, for Christmas one year, she gets me a gift. I can tell it's a CD, and I unwrap it on Christmas morning. And it's a CD from this guy, David Torn, called What Means Solid Traveler, that album on... I forget what label it was on. But I had never heard of this guy. And the album looked all crazy, you know. I was like, and so immediately I was like, whoa, you know, the picture of him inside, he's got this weird like snake hand or something, I forget, something like that. He's got the Klein guitar. So just the imagery of it already kind of spoke to me. I was like, wow, this looks pretty different. I think I'm going to like this. And I have no idea how she found this record, you know.
Wow.
I have a feeling she might have gone into like the local Sam Goody or whatever and been like, give me the craziest guitar album you have. And the guy behind the counter said, oh, hold on, I've got it for you. And he went into the back and came back with this package like, okay, careful, but here you go.
Here's what we do to drive out customers at 11 o'clock when we're closing down or whatever.
But I wore that CD out, man. That was another touchstone for me. That Engine Room, you know, there's a handful of other records that have had like a serious impact on my musical kind of thing, my aesthetic, if you want to say that, but that came from her. And I don't know, you know, it kind of got me into this idea of like, you know, oh, you can use electronics, you can use live sampling, you can make all these other sounds with the guitar, like extended technique, and make music out of it, make it sound like something as a greater whole by combining all of these sort of things that I was just sort of, I don't know, just sort of messing with, you know. So, yeah, the really intractable kind of experiences.
Yeah, you shouldn't ask her where she found it. No, I don't know.
I'd be totally mystified. Yeah, it might kind of ruin the mystery of it for me.
You must have told her that that had a huge, right?
I think I have, I think I have, and I think she was kind of like, oh, yeah, cool, you know.
Yeah. So you graduate Rutgers, and then what's next for you? What's the plan?
Actually, what's next at that point is kind of going off of these experiences, I want to figure out what I want to do with music. I want to combine all these things. I'm not happy just doing this, doing this genre-wise. And I kind of feel like, and I know that, okay, if I want to be a professional musician, there are going to be hard times, you know, just from talking to older mentor people.
Yeah.
And I thought like, okay, there's a lot of people, I think, doing music that are kind of maybe not like bullshitting fully, but I don't know if they are fully committed.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I didn't want to be another one of those types of musicians. Like if I'm going to be out there in the trenches trying to get gigs, that I want to make sure that I'm not stealing it from somebody who should be doing it more than me. You know, I wanted it to be 100%. So I sort of stopped playing a little bit. I moved back to Massachusetts where I'm from.
Yeah.
Western Mass. And I was up there for maybe a couple of years. And, you know, I didn't really play a lot for 6-8 months kind of thing. And I was just working odd jobs. I remember like delivering phone books around town, like just stupid.
The good old days.
Anyway, slowly I kind of like got back into playing the guitar, but it wasn't so much to pick it up because I had to practice like the Charlie Parker tunes every day to keep it up or whatever. But it was more like I started picking up the guitar more often because there was just, you know, a song I heard that I wanted to learn.
Yeah.
I put a Neil Young tune on, figure out the chords, whatever, right? Or just anything. And it started happening more and more frequently. And at that point, I figured, well, okay, I kind of came back to this much more naturally. And I don't have these sort of barriers to genre or, you know, the presumption I'm supposed to be doing this, I'm supposed to be doing that.
Yeah.
Anymore. And I thought that was a really healthy place to be in, to sort of dive back into music. And I taught some lessons up there and stuff too, but I ended up, I was on the guitar a lot more than I was, and I decided I needed to start playing with more people. So I moved to New York. So that's when I moved to New York City.
Wow.
Yep.
What guitar did you have back then?
I had my main guitar was a, it was an older ES-330, the hollow one, Gibson ES-330. But it was, I remember it was from 67. It wasn't from 68, because it was from 67, because it had all the high frets you couldn't really get to, because it had the neck joined like at the 12th fret or something stupid, you know. But it was also this like sparkling red finish.
Yeah.
It looked totally flashy. I liked it, but I felt like I couldn't do some of the things I wanted just kind of with that fret thing. So I went to the old Rudy's on 48th Street after I'd been in New York a couple of years, and I traded it towards an 80s 335.
Okay.
And I played that one for a long time. And actually, I'm just kind of remembering this. And then I was teaching at a music school up in the Bronx a couple of days a week. And it was actually a really cool school. They had a room full of instruments to lend to students if they couldn't afford instruments, but they wanted to take lessons. Mm-hmm. So they would just sign these out, you know, and they could take them home and practice them and stuff. But they had a couple of Fender Strats, like the Made in Mexico Strats or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of would get a little bit lazy with the commute, and I wouldn't bring a guitar, right? So I would just go in there and I'd grab a Strat and I'd teach on that. But, you know, like, I actually don't think I'd ever really played a Strat before. I'm like, you know, 28.
Yeah.
I'm 29 years old at this point. Been playing guitar since I was 13. I've never played a Stratocaster. So I was playing them there, and I was thinking, like, wow, this is really comfortable, and it sounds really good.
Yeah.
You know, and so I kind of borrowed one from them, and then I got my own sort of one off of Craigslist for, like, $300 or something.
Yeah.
And I started playing that one a lot more. Than the 335, I played a lot. And then at the same time, I had my dad's Les Paul custom.
Okay.
I swiped that from him at one point because he kind of only plays acoustic now these days. So I did him the favor of taking it off his hands.
That was nice. Yeah.
Hey, you know, I'm here to help. But so I was playing that a lot too. But, you know, once I got the Strat, playing the Les Paul and the 335 kind of seemed a little different. You know, I liked the way the Strat kind of fit into your body with the curves. And I dug the sound, maybe kind of because of the spring thing on the back. It seems sort of resonant. And the fingerboard is really comfortable. So at that point, I just started playing this like cheapo Strat all the time. I ended up selling the 335 at some point. The 335, yeah. Kept the Les Paul. Still have it, of course. And then I meet... you know, the whammy bar is kind of there, but I don't really mess with it too much. I kind of want to. I feel like if I could start all over again, I would go back and I would just play pedal steel, you know.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I love the vocal quality of that,
sure.
That kind of moaning sort of, you know, everybody thinks of it as this really sad.
Yeah.
Instrument, obviously, is capable of so many other things. I mean, you look at Susan Alcorn.
Yeah.
Like, completely reinvented the possibilities of that instrument with her. The Piazzolla stuff she does, or the Messiaen stuff. She's a big inspiration to me, also, her playing.
Yeah.
But there's so much sort of like emotional kind of way you can play. It's so vocal that I love it, you know. And I think the whammy bar gives you that on the guitar, you know, the tremolo bridge. So I kind of start messing with it a little bit. But around this time, this is probably 2011, 2012 or something, I end up getting to meet David Torn. Mm-hmm. We actually meet because Fryette is working on what becomes the Ether amp.
Okay.
And, you know, I'd been playing through deluxes and stuff like that and kind of not happy with my amp thing and becoming actually quite frustrated with, like, why can't I get a sound that I want? And I sort of stumble onto this thing that Fryatt's making, like online. He's putting up little demo videos or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's got this cool sound, you know, and sort of reading more about some of his amps, thinking like, oh, I wonder if this could be something for me, you know? So I think maybe I email Steve at a certain point. And then he puts me in touch with David because David's got the amp upstate and I'm in New York City this time. So David calls me. At a certain point, I think he kind of wants to vet me, like make sure I'm not like a psycho, and
sure,
which is totally fair. But we have a really great conversation on the phone, and after I hang up, I'm thinking like, wait a minute, this is the guy that I got this album when I was like 16 that changed my whole musical thing. It was really kind of a mind blow, you know. But he's, you know him. He's super generous, kindest soul in the world. He invites me up upstate to check out the amp while he's got it at his place. So I get up, we figure out a day, and I go up there, and I'm. You know, he kind of shows me a couple of things. And we talk about the amp-guitar relationship a lot. And it makes a lot of sense to me, you know. And, of course, the Ether isn't actually become available for a couple of years after this. But it starts me thinking about amps, you know.
Yeah.
And kind of thinking about, oh, maybe I should try some other things. And, you know, and I end up trying a Vox, like an AC-15. Like, I never tried a Vox. I'm, like, 30 years old. I never tried a Vox amp, you know. So sheltered.
Yes, no Strats, no Voxes.
I know, you'd think I'd never like seen a Beatles album or something before. But so, you know, David and I kind of hit it off a little bit, and he's been such a cool sort of friend, mentor to me, and very generous with his experience and information and time. And he hipped me to a lot of things he does with the tremolo system, with the whammy bar, kind of the diatonic transposition of certain chords and intervals and things like that. And I really ran with that. So I practice that a lot. I have notebooks full of chords that move to other chords when you pull up or push down a certain amount and triad things. And just sort of the vocal kind of appoggiatura stuff you can do with the whammy bar that I do all the time. These little moves that emote so much that have become really important to the way I play the instrument, the way I want to play the instrument.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fateful amp demo.
There's so many things where you can look back and I can't believe that they happen in a way.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many coincidences and connections that I feel very fortunate to have been able to have in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So your time in New York City was a little bit of teaching, a lot of gigging? A
lot of teaching.
Yeah, a lot of teaching.
A lot of teaching and a lot of gigging, but more teaching for the first sort of 6-7 years, you know. I mean, a lot of sessions, a lot of playing, practicing with other musicians throughout the day, writing music, working on new music with musicians, meeting a lot of people, going to hear a lot of music. Yeah. Not a lot of sleep, not a lot of money.
Yeah.
Some things don't change.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I moved to New York, I like kind of getting back to that idea, like, well, I know this is going to be kind of not the easiest life if I want to really pursue music. So I wanted to feel like I had to pursue music, you know, to kind of make sure I had a reason to get through those kind of tough times. But when I moved, I said, okay, if you're going to do this, you're going to commit to it. I'm going to put myself on a 10-year plan.
10-year plan, wow.
So I decided I'm going to move to New York, and I'm going to give it everything I can give it to kind of, like, deal with music. You know, I mean, yeah, kind of having a career to some extent, but I just want to play. I just want to make music. I want to figure out my music, and I want to figure out if this is a thing that can work, you know. So I said to myself, which, looking back, this is kind of insane, but I said to myself, if you're there and you've given it 110% for 10 years, and nothing is happening that you feel is of value, then take a gig, move to Montana and just do whatever you're going to do.
Yeah.
But you'll know, I won't regret it. I'll know that I gave it everything I could, you know. Mm-hmm. If something's happening at that 10-year mark where you feel there's been some value, you know, you can move if you want to, or you can stick it out and see what happens. So I kind of was doing stuff that I felt had value to it after the first couple of years, you know. And when that 10-year point kind of came around, I knew I was just going to sort of stay in New York because there was stuff happening. But I did think about it. I remembered kind of around when that 10-year mark was. And I could look back and think about, like, oh, I put out a couple albums on Fresh Sound New Talent, which was this label that also had a big impact for me in high school, just sort of modern jazz wise, the type of music that, you know, the first Kurt Rosenwinkel record, yeah. the, you know, Robert Glasper album on there, the first Bad Plus record is on there. Like, that was a really cool association. And Jordy Pujol, who runs Fresh Sound, was so kind to give my music a chance to have an outlet.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like forever indebted to him. So to have an association with that, and I was playing a lot and I was writing a lot of music and I was involved with some cool recordings and there was a lot on the horizon, mm-hmm. you know, so I just knew that I would kind of stay and kind of keep grinding it out for a while. But I felt really good at that 10-year mark because I could look back on this really crazy plan I set up for myself and feel like I had accomplished that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the date? Do you remember?
It was probably summer of, well, I would know the year. It was summer of 2013, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. Yeah. And I left in, I think, what's this, 2019?
Yeah.
And I think I left in 2016, summer of 2016. So I was there for about a little over 13 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that hard to leave New York?
In the sense that you like develop Stockholm syndrome, I think sometimes, you know, there are so many great things about living in New York as a musician. And so many of my friends still live there and I love seeing them and I love visiting and I love what it has to offer. But I just sort of needed a mental health break mm-hmm. from the day to day kind of difficulties of just, you know, doing your laundry or going to the post office or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Getting to the airport, forget it, you know?
Yeah.
So I relocated to Knoxville, Tennessee, a little over 2 years ago. And it's been really cool. I was worried at first. I was kind of thinking like, oh, nobody's going to call me again. But I was doing mostly my own projects anyways, with a handful of exceptions of other artists that I work with.
Yeah.
And what it's turned into is really a nice home base to be, where I kind of have a little more room,
yeah,
a little lower cost of living. I have a lot more space and time to focus on my music or whatever kind of crazy plan or tour I want to put together. And it's very easy for me to travel. You know, it's so easy to travel in general these days, but it's really easy to get back to New York. So I'm back there all the time. It's easy to fly to Los Angeles.
Sure.
It's easy to kind of get into the Midwest. And I'm close to Nashville now, and I have some really good friends there, and that's been a cool scene to sort of do some things in as well. And I teach at a couple schools in East Tennessee. I teach at East Tennessee State University in Johnson City. They have a jazz program, so I teach improv class lessons. So it's great, yeah.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, I don't have any reservations at this point. When I left New York, I definitely was, the first few months, I was like kind of, oh my God, what have I done? You know,
how was the New York City venues, the clubs? You know, was that still an important part of your career and development when you left, or were you kind of more like, I'm hunkering down and home, trying to come up with the compositions I want to come up with?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not so much like, you know, I mean, as Watt says, I am kind of like man alone in that sense now, but I really value the community of making music with people. So it is really important and always has been to me. But what I get to do is I get to plan it out a little more now.
Yeah.
You know, so I have time to kind of, perhaps sometimes I can overthink it because I have more time. But I can think about, oh, who might be good on this music? Where can we do it? Oh, it's on this date. We can rehearse on these dates.
Got
I can
it.
Set up this time. I got to fly on this date or drive or whatever. Nice. What am I going to bring? Instead of just sort of like, oh, I got to run out the door right now and do this. Oh, I forgot 20 things because I got to go to 10 other places after this. And
yeah.
I'll get home at 3 a.m. all exhausted and broke and stuff. So it's a little more, you know, just a little more organized, which I think suits my sensibilities a little bit to that extent. But, you know, that stuff is all about relationships, you know. Like the people that I want to play with, or the people I play with, the people I get to work on music with, you know, I really value the relationship, the friendship that I can form with those people. And it's the same thing with the venues I like, the venues I really love to perform mm-hmm. at, or the ones that I've been at a couple of times. It's because the people that run it, they get it. You know, they know it's about music and it's about community and it's a good vibe. And it lets the music be great, you know.
Yeah. And they're going to give you a gig no matter where you are because you're friends now and you have a relationship. Yeah.
Well, I would like to think so, but, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So speaking of relationships and segueing into gear, you mentioned the Fryette connection and fateful David Torn meeting. What else are you playing these days? What's
Yeah, well, mainly I play the Cole Superior there, which I think it's from 2015. Mm-hmm. I got it in 2017. You know, changed some of the pickups. The pickups now are Fralin Silent P90s with the Alnico pole pieces. And the kill switch that's in there was not original to the guitar. A great luthier in Knoxville, Tennessee named Steve Novelli did the work on that. And he's excellent. I would trust him with anything. And he builds really incredible instruments of his own as well. So I have this Superior. There's another Cole in process.
Nice.
Which we're excited about. Amp-wise, I've been using the Fryette Ether as sort of my main amp for a couple of years now.
Okay.
On the road and in studio stuff, silent recording, I've got the Fryette GPDI going, which is already... I've had it for maybe six months, something like that. It's already completely irreplaceable. It's such a Swiss Army knife of amazing amp sounds. You know, you can show up to a venue without an amp, no backline, plug this straight into front of house. And I've done that a number of times and been playing and not even, forgotten there's no amp.
Yeah.
Which is the ideal. You don't want to think about it. You want it to just influence, you know, you just want to be able to play, right? Play your best. Yeah. So that's a really great thing. Another Fryette amp that I got, actually the first Fryette amp I got was an older Pitbull 45 head. Still has the VHT plaque on it, but I recorded my album Spectre with that amp and a number of other things. So that's the main sort of amplification side of mm-hmm. things. Besides the Cole, I have it's a Strat. It's a Fender Strat. I think it's a American Deluxe. I forget all the different levels of whatever.
Yeah.
But it's got a mahogany body, and I sent that to Cole when I got it because I wanted the extended bridge route that he puts on the Tornado and stuff, so I can get that pull up where the bridge goes into the body.
Yeah.
So he did a lot of work on that. Actually, he did a little bit of electronics work. I think he drilled out the trem cavity. He also did some work on the fretboard. So that thing plays great. You know, this Cole modded Strat. So pictures of me with this red Strat with the two pickups. That's what that guitar is. So that was my main one before I got the Superior. And I use a lot of, I don't use a lot of effects compared to some people, but I use the ones that I think are important to what I want the music to be. So I have a trombet, Paul Trombetta fuzz pedal I use that kind of does a lot of oscillation feedbacky kind mm-hmm. of thing. Sort of like Fuzz Factory, but a better sounding version of that.
Sure.
What else do I use that's really important? I really love the new Lely volume pedal, mm-hmm. the one that works on like magnets or something. It's like real high science in that thing, man. There's like,
okay.
It solved every problem anybody's ever had with a volume pedal. This thing has solved it.
Okay.
And it's like a Sherman tank. You could throw this thing off the roof and pick it up and it would work. That's a really cool thing, especially when I'm doing the fake pedal steel stuff with the tremolo bar. So that's pretty indispensable. I also use I use the new Red Panda Tensor pedal, and I use that for sort of the shorter, glitchy kind of loops.
Yeah.
What I really love is that the way that pedal has it has a knob that I think is just labeled random, so you can turn up the amount of randomization that it applies.
Okay.
Which, as someone who's primarily considers himself an improviser, that's really important when you want to work with the electronics.
Yeah.
As kind of the fourth instrument in the trio, at least, you know, where I can play something, put it in this little sample, and then it can randomize the way it plays it back. That's very inspiring as an improviser, to have something work with you, or at least sort of give you something more to work with and keep you on your toes, as well as the rest of the band while we're playing. You know, it can really be this sort of fourth instrument in a trio. That goes out to a delay. Right now I'm using the DOD rubber neck analog delay, which has some cool little pitch things on it too. And then I use a Neuneiber wet reverb. Uh-huh. But I have it set up to kind of give a little bit of that Lexicon sort of high octave you know, we call it shimmer now, I guess, yeah. Right? But it's just a touch of that, and you can kind of manipulate stuff with that. In between the delay and the reverb, I have a send that goes out to sort of my big sampler, my big looper, which I use the Eventide time factor for that. But I just use it for the looper setting. I don't use any of the delays or anything like that. For a long time, I actually had I had two of the older Electro-Harmonix 16-second delays, the one that Nels uses all the time. And I love that kind of paradigm of grabbing something you're improvising or something that you're playing and bringing it back either to sort of mangle or to further improvise from or to use as a texture, as a background or something. But to always have it evolving, the idea of a static loop is very uninteresting to me. Mm-hmm. So I want to have something that I can sort of continually manipulate. And the time factor is kind of, at least a couple of years ago, one of the only ones that was being made that you could actually find, you know, that had qualities like that. So you could sample something really quickly live, which is important as an improviser. Sure. I don't want to set up something because maybe I'm going to loop something for 6.5 seconds and then I do it and then I go and make sure it's, you know, by that time the music's changed with who you're playing with, you know. So in this way, it's set up. It's really friendly to be live, you know, so I can grab something in there and I can manipulate it with speed and pitch. You can manipulate the start and length times of the loop, so you can kind of window through the loop in a smaller section. It has a filter thing on it. It has a few different ways of grabbing material, which kind of lends to different sounds. What I like most, I switched over to the H9 and controlled it with the iPad over Bluetooth.
Okay.
And that was cool. That was pretty cool. But what they did is they fixed something in the H9 version that is a glitch in the time factor, the hardware version.
Okay.
So I went back to the time factor. So you can have a loop running. This is pretty deep nerd stuff.
No, let's hear it. But I'm following so far.
You can have a loop running in the time factor, and then you can switch it over to like tap tempo mode.
Okay.
Right? So you push a button and now you're in like tap tempo mode, and you're supposed to be able to tap a tempo, right? And then you know, you record your loop to that is the idea. But if you've already got a loop in there that was not recorded to tap tempo and you go into tap tempo mode, it has to fit what's in there into the time. So it kind of doubles back on itself a little bit and it kind of glitches so that it fits this. But then if you change the tempo while that's happening, it causes it to glitch out even further.
Okay.
And then you go out of tap tempo mode and it saves all these glitches that are in there. So now you manipulate freely as you were without the tempo constriction, this sort of like mangled version of the loop, right? So you've ended up with something different than you started with, which is kind of my aesthetic for that. But on the H9, they don't let you do it. You can't.
So you
had
to go back.
Yeah, you can't go into tempo mode on the iPad thing. Wow. So I went back to the hardware because I don't want, sometimes there's a glitch and people fix it and then you get the fixed version and you go, oh, that's not as cool as when it wasn't working right.
Yeah. Wow. Just got to let that soak in for a second. All that info. So speaking of improv, most of the record, the new record, was improvised and you then diced it up and did
well, those longer pieces for sure. Yeah. And then there's improvised sections on the other pieces. And then there's a couple little solo parts that were pretty heavily written out. Yeah.
So when you're doing a live show, do you attempt to replay the improvised stuff from before or do you just go off in a whole new direction?
Well, what we've done on this tour being the kind of album release tour, the Watt actually went back and relearned his bass lines that he improvised for these two tracks. So he went back and checked them out and, you know, he practiced them and they're rock solid as expected. So he sets up the vibe of these two separate pieces on the album by reworking the bass line. And sometimes they're different. He's been changing them up, improvising with them himself, which has been really cool. But we're able to kind of play something that I say is inspired by the music on the album. The things that I'm playing, I don't really have an interest in recreating them, but the vibe of those pieces is set up and also changed. Actually, Data Point, the feeling is completely changed. Steven has brought so much to the table, you know, coming up with his own drum parts, which is great, which is what I wanted. That changes the feel from the album. So it's, yeah, music inspired by Wall of Flowers in quotes would be a good way to put it.
All right. And you're still touring for another few weeks?
Yeah, we finish on March 30th in New York City. So, yeah, we're in Seattle now, and we end up going all the way across the country.
We'll get this podcast out quickly. Get the word out.
Cool. Yeah, you can find the tour dates on MikeBeghetta.com, and you can find the album on my Bandcamp page.
And as we just talked before this podcast started, you're on the new David Torn record.
I'm on the new David Torn record, amazingly. Yeah. Yep.
You're the middle chunk.
Yeah, this track, well, tracks. Son of Goldfinger album on ECM with Tim Byrne and Chez Smith, one of the greatest bands in the world. There's three tracks, but they did a vinyl release, which only has two of the tracks.
Oh, okay.
Which does have the middle Spartan Before It Hit. That's the track that I'm on, along with another great guitarist named Ryan Ferreira, great friend of mine, who is in Electric Snake Oil, Tim Byrne's band. And the Scorchio String Quartet, led by Martha Mook, and pianist Craig Taborn. So we all got to contribute something to that second track. But like I said, I actually haven't listened to it yet. I'm saving it for when I get off the road, so I can really dig in and not kind of freak myself out about the enormous weight of that gratitude.
All right, Mike. Thanks for coming here.
Thanks for having me. This has been super fun.
Yeah, it was.